yes, I want to put that thing about the Microsoft using a nuclear power plant to power there.
Get the, oh, yeah. The nuclear powered AI. We won't even be able to block out the sun, you know, like in the Matrix.
No, that's it.
No, they're doing it to justify their prices on Microsoft licenses.
Welcome to GCP Bytes episode number 2 for Friday, the 27th of September 2024. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, Google are in the magic quadrant. Is Qualcomm set to create the largest tech buy ever? We take a look at some new Google hardware, and how are we going to power the AI future in the AI wars? But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you going, Dave?
I am doing awesome, thanks, mate. How about yourself?
Awesome, awesome. And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, bud?
I'm good, mate. How are you guys going?
Oh, we're going good. Oh, I'm still recovering from this flu, hey. Oh, God, it's killing me.
Oh. Yeah, no thanks. You can keep that. I've had enough of the flu this year.
Yep, and this is one advantage of, you know, remote podcasting. We don't have to be in the same room sharing all that air and nasty bacteria germs, and viruses.
Yeah, I don't have to be anywhere near your gross microphone.
No, you do not. I might take this windsock and burn it after this.
The sacrificial windsock.
Awesome, awesome. Anyone been up to any tech adventures during the fortnight?
Oh, you know, there's been a few. Because as you guys know, we got our new caravan sort of 2 weeks ago, and so we headed off on a trip on Saturday to a little motorbike park out west of Gympie called Manar Park, which was a fantastic fun trip because my young fella loves his motorbiking. So he's cracking around the entire place. It's a massive property. But there's no internet out there at all. Like in any way, shape or form, you get like one bar of 3G when you stand right on the top of a hill, which is a good 500 meter walk.
Yep, yep.
So I vetoed that and I went and bought Starlink. And I ordered Starlink actually before the last podcast. And it just never turned up. It just stuck in, we're preparing your order. And then I found out that BCF actually has it. So I cancelled the order. I wandered down to BCF and I bought the Starlink, $300 cheaper than what the Starlink website was charging me.
They had the units in stock.
They have the units in stock. They had two of them there. So I said, good, put one aside. And in that 5 days that we're at Manar Park, we consumed 193 gig. Of traffic. So that was me on a couple of phone calls. Obviously, we did the pre podcast meeting with you guys on,
and the quality was great. Like when we had you on that call, it was perfect.
We were getting 260 meg down and 15 meg up. It's cracking along. Yeah. So, and then
watching,
of course,
Netflix in the evening and that, or
Netflix. Yeah. We were watching a whole heap of stuff at night. We just sort of curl up in the caravan, put the telly on. We've got the Chromecast, the white one in there, the 4K one, which is fantastic. And then at the same time as I ordered the Starlink, I decided that, hang on a second, I'm going to need some way of powering this on 12 volt because we're not always going to be on a powered site. So I ordered myself a buck converter or a step-up converter that goes from 12 volt to... And wait for it, Starlink requires 57 volts.
Of course it does.
Because, you know, 57 volts is a perfectly normal number. So I ordered one of them at great cost. And that's my next job is wiring that up. But that's the tech adventures for me.
Really awesome thing, though, with the Starlink is, you know, the more remote you are, the better your like individual cell performance is because you're competing with a lot less people.
Yeah.
So it's really just absolutely perfect for places like that. The the next thing that's really exciting, though, is you're going to be able to have it on your phone in the not-too-distant future. Yep. They've already started piloting that with, like, phones that you can buy today. You don't need to buy a sat phone or an Iridium device or anything like that. You will be able to get, like, basic phone, basic text, emergency coverage on, like, almost any phone everywhere. Like, yeah, just...
Yeah. But honestly, if you're not going to go out and buy yourself a brand new phone, it took me, I don't know, probably 10 minutes to get it all set up in the caravan, plugged in and get it online. It doesn't take long to get working. So if you do need to make an emergency phone call, we've got Wi-Fi calling turned on the phones and you just connect it to the Starlink and off she goes.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm probably more getting it from like just a general emergency, like someone hiking and stuff. So not like where you've got the whole Starlink dish. I know they've got the backpack ones and stuff now, but, you know, just someone who, like, wanders off a path and gets lost with their phone, like, now you'll be able to have coverage everywhere.
Yeah, I think that's good.
No, it certainly sounds the goods. And, you know, I've got one of those Telstra 5G dongles, and I think I'm paying for 400 gig, something like $110 a month or something. On that, so I mean, when you look at it, what are you paying for the Starlink? Yeah.
So the Starlink's quite a bit more expensive than that. It's $195 a month, but the I suppose with that, it's a far better solution because I don't require a cell tower. I can connect this. I could be in the middle of the desert in Australia where there is no coverage for hundreds of kilometers, and I put this up and I've got like high speed internet and low latency, high speed internet too. Our latency was sort of averaging around the 25 to 30 milliseconds.
Yeah. 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 I'm not going to get that, but you know, the 5G dongle is kind of this big, you just turn it on and stick it in your bag and you're done, right? You don't have to, you know, have this big satellite. So there's pros and cons each way.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it certainly sounds cool.
What about you, Banky? What have you been up to? We've seen a few of your exploits going on in the chat. So
I did send you a few photos through during the week. Yes, playing around with a Commodore 64. I think I mentioned it last week. I got it out. I started, making a few moves on trying to get it working. Now, Facebook Marketplace must have known that I'd been talking about this or looking this up, and I went on Facebook Marketplace to look for bunk beds for our spare room of all things, and of course the first thing that comes up on Facebook Marketplace is a Commodore 64 in the same suburb, two streets away, a guy was selling.
Nice.
And I was like, well, and it looked newer than mine. Everything's well. I've got to get it just so I can swap the chips around. And so I got it, brought it back, turned it on. It came up with a screen, but didn't work properly. Swap one of the chips from my busted one, and bang, it did work. The Vic chip came up, worked.
Nice.
Went, great. Okay, it's working. Sent you guys that other little video of the floppy drive. The floppy drive's all worked. Was able to load games up, play it. I'm like, yes, I'm on. This is great.
I have to say, seeing the you busting out the floppy disk drive cleaner with the big 5 1/4, I'm like, oh no.
The old isopropyl alcohol and that felt thing that's inside it. Yep, remember those.
It was the whole thing, the whole shooting match. So I'm like, great, this is all working. Now, we get to the monitor. Now, you saw the monitor was black and white, and that was because I was using a VGA, a SVDA to VGA converter. It wasn't real good. I've got this thing in there called ChromaFix where you can adjust the chroma settings coming out of the Vic chip. So I played around with that, tried to get a picture of it, didn't look good. Now, I had another monitor, which is a Dell 2001 FP. It's a 4:3 ratio, a Dell ultra-sharp monitor. But the thing about that monitor is it's got an S-video and a composite input.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yep. As well as an RGB and a digital input, right? So it's perfect for vintage machines because you've got the analog inputs. Now, it didn't work. Now, I'd had... I'd had a board, the internal board, which is made by BenQ. I got the serial number and I Googled and I found a dude in the US that had the internal board, would you believe, for sale. So I'd ordered that a while ago and it was just a punt, right? It was just a punt that was the problem. And I swapped it in and bingo, it came up. It worked. The monitor started working.
That's fantastic.
It was like $60 or something, right? So I'm like, you know what? This monitor is going to be the monitor. This is it worked. And I turned it on, and the picture came up. It looked fantastic, but in the between that, now the way these LCDs are built, there's a I don't know exactly, but there are layers, right? There are layers. There's a plastic cover and another layer, blah blah blah. In one of those layers where I'd had it stored, moisture must have got in there, and some fungus has grown in there.
Oh, gross!
So you can see this. You can see this fungus outline in the middle, right? The picture still comes through, but it's sort of washed out where the fungus is, right? So I can dismantle that and clean that out and put it all back together, and it'll be perfectly working in it at that point. So, and I want to use this monitor, obviously, because of the inputs in it. So I thought, well, why don't I try and just burn the fungus out, right? I'll just try and do that. I saw some dudes on YouTube doing this, right?
So some guy on the internet said I can set my monitor on fire.
Do this, right? YouTube advice 101.
YouTube advice 101. So leave the monitor on. Remember the poke codes to put the screen in white, so it's like at maximum output. Left it on overnight, right? Just burn this, right? Came back. It was still on. It was still all on. It was all good. And I came back, but I hadn't fixed the fungal problem. Oh, right. Okay. I'll reset the computer. I'll reset the Commodore 64. Just go back to the regular. Reset it. Go to reset it. Bang. Didn't reset. Came up with junk on the screen. So it's dead now. It turns on, but you just get the whole screen full of junk characters. And
so,
it's probably.
So wait,
probably,
the screen has died? The Commodore 64
Commodore
has
64
died.
Has
Commodore 64
has died. Commodore 64 has died. So it's probably a memory addressing problem.
Or have a look at the RAM chips on it, because if they're the MT RAM chips, I know that they're really dodgy. The MT RAM chips or the MOS chips, if they made the RAM chips in it, they're dodgy as.
Dodgy as. And because it had been on overnight, which is kind of good, it's a burn-in test, right? So that's where we're at the moment. It boots, it's got this weird ass just full of random junk characters. Now, I have on order a multi-test cartridge. Now, the thing about these multi-test cartridges that you get is the way that it works. The predecessor of the Commodore 64 was Commodore's Max machine. And the Commodore Max was a 6502 machine, but it only had 4K of RAM. And it had like a cut-down set of chips. Now, when you put a cartridge in the Commodore 64, the cartridges can be made to be backwards compatible with the Mac 64 or the Commodore Max. Now, to do that, what they do is the cartridge port goes into what's called Max mode. You can send us the cartridge can, I think it shorts out two of the pins and it sends the computer into Max mode. And the idea behind that is so that any Max cartridges that you plug into the 64 are still compatible with the 64. That was one of the selling points. Now, I'd not heard of the Commodore Max. I don't think it was retailed here in Australia.
No, it was a US only thing, I think.
It was a US only thing, right? But this mode exists on all Commodore 64s. Mm. Now, the advantage of that is the machine, as long as the base 4K of RAM and the CPU and the VIC are working, the machine can start up.
So it's right? like a limp home mode.
It's like a limp mode, right?
It's basically like BIOS.
It's like what a BIOS mode. Yeah. That's right. So you can have all these other problems on the machine. Now, if it's a memory, like a high memory problem or problems with the CIA or whatever, then all of that is switched off when it goes into Max mode and the machine can still boot up. So I'm hoping when I get this Diag cartridge and I plug it in that enabling Max mode will be enough. And then when it's in Max mode, it can run tests on all the chips and then it can tell me where the problem is. So that's my sort of course of action with that, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah,
that sounds like some oscilloscope fun.
There was oscilloscope. Well, I did have oscilloscope fun with the 128. I did some probing and et cetera with the 128, and I've narrowed it down to two ICs. One's a TTL buffer, and the other's a TTL inverter, 7406 and a 7407. So I can just go to JCar, buy those parts and swap them in. A pretty common problem, apparently. Yeah, maybe I'll get the 128 alive as well. But, yeah, I'm working on two or three things at the moment as far as that goes. But I did do some retro brighting on the drives, as I showed you.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, so I think it has removed some of the yellow. but I'm just going to leave it as it is at the moment. I spray painted those drives and they look $1 million. And when I opened them up, there was next to no dirt or anything inside. They were pristine inside, so I was really happy with that. And as you saw, that they do work. So when it's all coming together, it should be a really nice little system.
I love that the 74LS logic chips are still available. That's so good.
Yeah, yeah. Now there is a hack you can do with the 74 logic chips. You can just sit them on top of the ones that are in circuit. And you can quickly identify. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You can identify if that's the problem or not.
You got to push down fairly hard on them to make sure they make contact.
Make contact.
I like just piggyback off the existing ones without desoldering.
Yeah. Because all the so in the at least the later revisions of the board, they're all soldered in.
Yeah.
And so as long as the legs on the chip in place are clean, you can piggyback another one on top of it, and if that chip is faulty, you'll remove the fault because the chip you're sitting on top is then using it.
Yeah. it just goes in parallel through the ones that do work. Like if it's like a logic gate with like six gates in it, it'll go in parallel through the ones that do work, and the one that doesn't work, well, it'll pick that one up.
Yeah,
amazing.
Yeah.
Do you reckon is there any technology that's being made today that people are going to have the same following about in, 40 years' time, trying to, bring it back? I mean, maybe consoles. I can see sort of consoles being a thing, but no one's going to grab, I've got, a random, a Dell mini PC.
No, it's interesting. My young fella's got this love for old Nokia phones. And so we picked up a bundle of them off, it was like half a dozen or something of them, off eBay for $40. And they got delivered yesterday before we got home. And so, of course, we get home and he's ripping these things out of the bags and he's charging them all up and they all still work.
I mean, they won't connect to any networks, but...
What was the meme I saw the other day? I found my phone that I lost in 1992 in the woods and it still had one bar of charge.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, well, two of the phones powered up straight out of the box. The others were dead. And there's a Nokia 3310, there's a Nokia 3315. And for those who don't know, the difference is that the 15 had the joined buttons, whereas the 10 had all the individual buttons. And there was like an X302, and there's a whole heap of different Nokia phones in there.
Just remember how good we all got with being able to do the SMX. Well, I can't remember what the name of that typing is, but we could all just do that. You could have your hand in your pocket and just be SMSing your mates.
Yeah. But I don't know what it is. It's something about the 8-bit hardware that's just got this allure. It's accessible, right? It's you can analog. You can almost see what's going on, right? At the bit level, right?
And it's easy enough to understand for people who aren't technically in that mindset of I know how to debug really complex logic. It's they're easy enough to get your head around, and there's enough manuals online for it and all the rest. It's good fun.
Right. Because everything hasn't been abstracted away, you can trace it. It's more like being a mechanic than current day sort of computing.
Yeah, it's there's no sort of FPGAs or anything like that on those old machines. It's all TTL logic, and it's fairly easy to follow where stuff goes because the traces are big enough. The pins
it's all
are
laid
big
out
enough.
In front of you, right? It's like a microservice architecture almost, right?
Yeah.
It's all laid out in front of you, and it hops from here to there, right?
Yep.
And does it help that this was built by hand in a garage in California?
Well, yeah, if you're working on the old Apples, absolutely. Yeah.
Did you see, anyway, did you see that one? Did you just see that original Apple that Steve Wozniak built by hand, sold because it was at the Living Computer Museum, and it sold for astronomical amount of money.
Yeah. In a suitcase.
Mm.
All right. Well, look, outside of that, I sat a certification, a recert. Would you believe, on top of all of that, and I've been sick, last Wednesday I sat a recert for the Pro Architect and I passed.
Yay. Congratulations.
Yes, thank you. Now, I just have to say straight out of the gate, I think I mentioned this last time I did it, they hit you with the case studies, and the case studies were questions were all on EHR healthcare. And Helicopter Racing League. There were no questions on Mount Kirk Games or Terram Earth, which I found interesting.
Okay. That is interesting because originally they were all on, most of them were on Terram Earth and Mount Kirk Games. So I wonder whether that's an indication of where Google sees the use coming from.
Yeah, well, Terram Earth, it was pretty obvious to me that a lot of the questions were around IoT and IoT Core with Terram Earth.
Which has been gone for a long time now.
Which has been gone for a long time, right? So there were no questions around IoT and IoT Core in the test. I'm just trying to cast my mind back now because it's been over a week and I've been crooked in the meantime, so it's a bit. I've got a bit of brain fog what was in the exam. But
well, you did do a bunch of the skills boost preparation stuff, right?
I did.
So how close do you feel that aligned to the actual exam?
Look, I think my strategy was I actually went in. Did I mention this last fortnight that I found the upgrade course from the
Associates like 200 questions or something, and then there was a lot.
Yeah. Now that was a knowledge test question, a knowledge test thing, right? They weren't, the questions weren't scenario based questions like they would be in the exam, right? So if you can do that, you'll be right with the exam, right? Okay. That's not a problem, right? And then if you can do the test questions, the sample questions, you'll also, you know, and you're used to the way those scenarios are put to you, then you'll be right with the exam as well. Because I have noticed that they reduced the length of some of the questions. Some of the questions were really wordy in previous incarnations. Mm. And it was, trying to hold all of that in your, you know, context window. My brain's context window is tiny, right? So I have to constantly go back and reread. Then it was challenging, but they have reduced that somewhat.
You need more L2 cache.
Yeah. I need the Gemini large token.
Large context window.
Context window.
Some of the questions were gimmies. They were really easy. And then I can't for the life of me remember now the specifics, but somewhere I had to go back and review. But I used my same strategy. I put an answer on all the questions. The one that I was sus on, I hit the review flag, and then I went back and I reviewed them all. And then the ones that I had the review flag on, I just had a second guess at it and just said, well, you know what, that's my best punt, and just moved on.
But I've never found – like, so I – when I do exams, I do the same thing. I flag them to go back later. I don't know if I've ever actually gone and changed my answer after having done it, though.
I have.
Once or twice, though. Only once or twice. It's not a rare occurrence. It's not a regular occurrence.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where so they word the question a little bit ambiguously, and I was sort of like, oh, I think this question is about this, and I'll put the answer in, and then when I go back and review it, I'll reread the question and go, oh, hang on, that question's got nothing to do with the answer I put in there. This is the answer for that.
Yeah. Or later on you get another question that's kind of similar, but and it changes the context in your brain.
Yep.
You go, oh, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
I've got a series of tests coming up now. I've got it all in quick succession, bang, 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 between now and sort of May. And, that'll be my refresh cycle.
Lots of study for Banky.
Lots of study for Banky. That's it. All right, cool. Let's get on with the rest of the show. Hey, enough banter for now.
Yep. Oh, I thought this is we're going to wrap up the show. We're done. We've got a half an hour here. We're done.
Lots of tech news today. Lots of tech adventures. But let's get on with the community news. Now, Ian, you've thrown all these in here, and I know squat about any of them, so off you go.
Cool, thanks. So just a big shout-out for the DevFests that are going on. So GDG Melbourne's DevFest is happening 5th and 6th of October, or I think it's actually just a Saturday, the 5th. I'll be down speaking at that. GDG Auckland's DevFest is happening on the 10th of November, and I'll be at that speaking. And GDG Sydney Study Jam for Gen AI was moved from last week to now the 11th of October. So I'll be down for that as well. So if you haven't registered for that Study Jam, quick, do it.
Quick go and register, yeah. I've registered. So yeah, you'll find links for all of those in the show notes. I'm not aware of any other community events, so that's probably it for the community news. All right then, let's get on with the news items. And first news item for this week is Google. Google ranks in the magic quadrant for container management. What is this? Like, come on, guys. Tell me what this is, because I've got my own opinions on what this ranking is.
Yeah, look.
You're not a big Gartner guy?
Yeah, yeah, that Gartner dude. He put some dots in some squares and calls it a magic quadrant.
And I know it costs an absolute fortune to be a member.
Be in it. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But this one should come as no surprise. I mean, Google was the creator of containers. So it comes as no surprise that they're ranked as a leader for the second year in a row in Gartner's Magic Quadrant for Container Management. What I do find a little interesting, though, is if you have a look at the Magic Quadrant, Google is actually behind AWS and Microsoft, even though, like...
Now, this was going to be my point on this. Google's calling this out, and look, it's great that they're in this Magic Quadrant, but they're in it with everyone else. It's no big deal. Like, everyone seems to be there.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I mean, that's come from them in the anyway, because, I mean, they've released Borg as Kubernetes, and Kubernetes has now just been taken up by all of the major cloud providers. What I do find interesting is that given that they do this day in, day out, this is their bread and butter, that they're not the leader in it.
Mm.
And you find that Microsoft is actually ahead of them in the completeness of vision, even though Google are the ones who drive the Kubernetes development.
But I suppose it's not going to be just kubes, right? Like, it's not just can you run containers. If it's completeness, then we're talking about like full end-to-end life cycle. It's going to be how everything gets in. It's going to be, you know, security testing. It's going to be like the whole kit and caboodle around it.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong, it's still surprising that they're not, you know, like all the way in front. However, given that so much of the product suite is available to AWS, available to Microsoft, I suppose they, you know, every one quarter they may have an innovation that puts them in front until everyone else backports it.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's
and
right.
What about other services like Cloud Run and, there are other container services, Cloud Functions and stuff? I mean,
I think Google was late to the party with Cloud Functions because, I mean, AWS had had, I think,
Lambda.
They call it Lambda, yeah,
yeah.
For years. The ability to just run a function as a service for years and years and years, and then Google came along and went, oh, we should probably do that. But when it comes to containers, I do think that Google's implementation of Kubernetes is quite possibly the simplest to get your head around from the get-go and the most powerful because of that.
Right. Well, especially when you're using autopilot, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But then, so, and for that, those who don't know, Kubernetes is now 10 years old from the time of when Google sort of released Borg to the open source community. So it's been going strong for 10 years.
Hmm. You know what I find more interesting about this graph?
Hmm.
The disparity, the difference between Canonical and Red Hat.
Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, I would have expected, you know, if both of those players were sort of midfield or to clustered closer together, but I would not have expected Canonical to be like at the back of the pack.
Well,
and Red Hat right at the front of the pack. Like, well, I mean,
so Red Hat's OpenShift is very containerized. You containerize pretty much everything that you can. Canonical put all their eggs into the OpenStack basket. And that's why you see them there with Mirantis, who are the core developers of OpenStack these days. And so OpenStack is not container management in any way, shape, or form. It is it's pretty sort of old school, let's run compute engines everywhere.
Mm. Yeah, right. Yeah, I suppose if we're narrowing it down specifically to containers, then that makes sense.
Yeah.
And you can see where, like, you got Broadcom / VMware eking their way forward just a slight bit because of Tanzu, but I've still never been able to really get my head around, like, why you would bother.
No, I don't. Like, really, if you're going to go to that extent, just run Kubernetes on VMware.
Mm. Or you just put it somewhere else and don't pay the VMware tax.
Yeah, and avoid the VMware tax. Yeah, that's right.
Because you don't want to manage your nodes.
That's exactly right. But yeah, so that it was an interesting article. It's some really weird placings in there, which I won't suggest are financially driven, but they might well be financially driven.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's interesting enough. Let's move on. And this is a cool feature. Hyperdisks now available on GKE blocks as GKE block storage.
Yeah. Yeah, Hyperdisk. So Hyperdisk is their next generation network block storage. So for all that use Google Cloud, you've obviously got your standard PD, then you've got Balance, which is sort of a hybrid SSD spinning Rust type thing. And then you've got SSD persistent disk. And now we've got Hyperdisk, which is really, really quick. Disk where you can provision not only capacity but also the throughput and IOPS for the disk, and then to augment that further, so Hyperdisk, much the same as all other block storage, is thick provisioned. So as soon as you provision it, you pay for that full provision, the full capacity that you provision. Sorry, whereas Hyperdisk storage pools are a thin provision, so you provision how much storage you want and what IOPS and throughput you want on that pool, and then as you consume it, you're charged for it, which is really good for various use cases. We use it in my daily work for SQL Server. So we've got SQL Server database that does dumps to disk that need to be restored to other servers. And we use a storage pool there. It dumps it down to disk. It ships it over to like the other machine, grabs that dump, uploads it, and then deletes it.
Yeah, so right. So you just get to pay for the one allocation, and then you get to split it across the workloads as required.
Yeah. Mm. You can split it across multiple workloads. So
that's good. Well, it gives you a way to be able to do that. Committed use discounting without having to say, like, okay, well, this particular application is going to have this bucket of disk for the duration.
Yeah, well, and that's right, because if you have a look at our SQL servers, and it's not really a good use case, but if you have a look at our SQL servers, we're like 30 terabytes of storage on each one of them. But in GKE, Google are claiming here that the storage pool for Hyperdisk allow you to lower the storage TCO by as much as 30 to 50% and are available as of Kubernetes 1.29.2. So you just mounted the PVC, referencing the storage pool SC storage class, and you provision however much storage you want in that persistent volume claim.
Mm-hmm. So really easy to use and score yourself a discount. So it's a real just no-brainer.
And super, super fast disk.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you can provision, I think we've got ours set at 80,000 IOPS and 2,000 megabytes per second of throughput. So they scream along.
Yeah. Very good. Get on it. Save yourself some money.
Yeah. Save yourself some money in the meantime. That's right. All right, cool. Let's just move on with the next article. And Dave, this could be a big one, but Qualcomm is reportedly wants to buy Intel.
Yeah, so I mean, it's been an interesting and sad time for Intel recently. They've taken some pretty big hits. They've got some long-term plans that they want to try and turn the company around, like spinning off some of their foundry stuff. However, like, you know, they're down significantly on their market cap, which does mean that for certain other companies, which are having their heyday right now, gives them the capacity to kind of sniff around, and that's Qualcomm right now. So Qualcomm's kind of valued right now at about where Intel was a year ago. Intel's now the smaller, and yeah, they're
A big drop, isn't it?
That's a big drop. So they've been inquiring. It's still very early days. I think if that was to go through, there would be antitrust investigations going in because changing ownership of an x86 license. Like, forget everything else that goes along with just chip manufacturing, but just there's so much that's tied up in how the x86 licenses and the AMD 64 licenses and who can own them. That I'm skeptical that this would actually come off. But it definitely shows that nothing's too rosy for Intel at the moment.
I find it interesting. Intel's missed the calling a few times in its past. Like, you have a look at the rise of smartphones and Intel just like, they'll never take off. We're not going to bother developing a chip for them. And they really missed the boat there.
Yeah, but I mean, you can go back further. You can go back to, IA64, like the Itanium stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And even something more recent was with the AI stuff where they just missed the boat completely on the processors to do AI, and now they're playing catch up.
Yeah, I mean, like, and we've seen now their first forays, like the Lunar Lake stuff, which we touched on last fortnight. Mm-hmm. Where they are starting to see an uptick there, and I think also we can spin back a few years when they started to get back into like the GPU game.
Because that Arc, it was the Arc GPU, wasn't it?
Arc GPU,
reportedly was actually really good. Like, but by comparison to the top of the range NVIDIA GPU, it wasn't much. But
nah.
But for a first sort of foray into GPUs.
I'll try and dig it out. The numbers were something like NVIDIA had something like 88% of the market. And ATI, AMD had 12%, and Intel had a fat donut of the market. So
anyway, so not looking good there. While I don't think that Qualcomm's actually going to be successful on this one, they might be looking for other acquisitions. So
yeah, well, are they going to look at AMD if it doesn't come off with Intel?
Well, AMD's worth more than Qualcomm at the moment, so. So and that, there you go. In terms of like turnarounds again, like go back from like say previous, like before Ryzen, when AMD was absolutely on death's door.
Yeah.
And now they're quarter of $1 trillion worth. So.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot of coin.
Oh yeah, that's a lot of billions.
Yeah.
More billions than Intel has right now.
That's it. All right, well, we'll keep an eye on that because, I mean, if there's a purchase like that, that really will reshape the tech industry, right? There'll be a big shake-up.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect, even if they got it, I don't think they would get it holus bolus. They would need to split massive chunks of it apart.
Yeah, yeah. Pending all the approvals, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, and while we're on the subject of retro computing, the Paul Allen Estate has sold the remaining living computer artifacts and systems to a museum near Atlanta. What's this all about, Ian?
Yeah, so the Living Computer Museum, which... I'm so disappointed. So I was slated to go to Google Next back in 2020, and when COVID hit, and this was going to be one of my stops. I was going to go to Living Computer Museum because, oh my God, it has got so many really cool retro machines in there, including one of my all-time favorites, a Cray supercomputer. Mm-hmm. So the Paul Allen Estate announced on Thursday that it sold the remaining historical computers and technology artifacts and systems, the storytelling content and all the exhibits, materials previously housed at Living Computer Museum, to the Computer Museum of America, which is located in Roswell, about 20 minutes outside of Atlanta. And yeah, this sort of marks the end of the Living Computer Museum. It really hasn't opened since COVID hit, so it closed down at beginning in COVID, and it hasn't opened since, which is sad because they have got some really cool gear in there, like the original Apple computer that Steve Wozniak built by hand. Like I said before, a Cray supercomputer, and I think
some old PDP.
Yeah, some old PDP. So yeah. I think Dave Plummer from Dave's Garage on YouTube, he actually bought one of the PDP 1134s from LCM. So yeah, it really, really cool museum that shows the history of computers right from the get-go to today, essentially.
Still pretty sad to see it go. And
yeah,
you know, I guess that shows like the estate didn't have an interest in running that.
Quite possibly didn't have an interest or couldn't find people to do it. Paul Allen, obviously one of the co-founders of Microsoft, a very well-regarded computer scientist. He's obviously got some talent there, or he had before he died, and I suppose the people surrounding him either didn't have the talent or couldn't get the talent in to keep restoring this stuff.
I can tell you from firsthand, it's challenging. It's very difficult to keep these old computers running, right?
Yeah, very.
You've got minutes
very
of runtime on your Commodore 64.
Minutes.
We just update the BIOS out of band. It'll be fine. They don't have a baseboard computer management system.
No. Yeah, they constantly break down, constantly need new parts. A couple of videos I saw on YouTube, you know, that they built new power supplies. Typically, that's one of the problems, right? The power supplies were so dodgy and poorly built. They feed it bad power and they don't last. So they redesigned the power supplies for cleaner power. And, the skills required to do that, they're getting rarer and rarer because people just aren't doing that now, right? That's not what you're learning when you learn computers.
No, you learn to, if the power supply doesn't work, throw it out and put a new one in.
Exactly, yeah.
But I did find Dave's Garage, the video that he put out, really interesting because he actually went through his PDP 11 and pulled it apart and replaced a whole heap of stuff. And like there was some people there that were fuming at him because he got it home and instead of like checking over everything meticulously to make sure it wouldn't explode when he powered it up, he just plugged it in and powered it up to see if it worked, which is exactly what I would have done.
That's what you do.
Like I bought this because I think it's cool.
Yeah. I don't want to run it. I want to see it do some stuff. Yeah. All right. Well, sad news there. And we'll keep an eye out, see if any of the artifacts from that museum, see where else they end up, because they're going to be in some interesting places. Some YouTubers and that will probably show up in their channels.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Moving on then. More Google news. Google GCP flaw fixed after Composer vulnerability found. So this, what's this all about, Ian? Sounds like Composer.
So Cloud Composer, which is a sort of Google's version of Apache Airflow has had, sorry, it doesn't anymore. It had a supply chain 0 day, essentially, that Tenable, the security firm, has dubbed Cloud Imposer. So Cloud Imposer could have allowed attackers to conduct dependency confusion attacks on Cloud Composer, a managed service version of the popular Apache open source, Apache Airflow service. So it's, from what I read in the article, it is the extra index URL argument that sent allows you to specify an external repository of Python packages that you can install and thereby compromise the supply chain inside of Airflow.
Right. And they've changed that now to the index URL argument instead of using the extra index URL.
Yeah, that's right. So this was fixed back in May. Google have fixed it by ensuring that the Python packages are only installed from a private repo. So you can't sort of use some dodgy external repo that's been compromised.
Yep. Well, that makes sense really, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, of course.
All right. So, yeah, just be aware if you're using Composer that you've got to make sure you're using the correct index URL. I guess that's the upshot of that. Awesome. And all right, moving on. Now, Dave, you were supposed to have a Chromebook or Chromebook info was supposed to be released.
I had big plans.
What's going on here?
I kind of talked about it last fortnight that there was there's supposed to be the big Chromebook fall release in New York City. There's supposed to be a big event. This was like 2 days ago. All quiet on the Western Front. Everyone who went there, I think, must have had to sign NDAs. I think there's the event happened, but I have not been able to find one thing that came out of it.
Really?
Yeah. So, and I was so excited. And again, I kind of touched on this last fortnight, is I'm in the market for one, right? I want to buy a new Chromebook. I really like the look of what I was seeing with these Lunar Lake CPU ones, which they're quite performant. I can't find anything. I found literally one guy in Australia managed to get his hands on a Lunar Lake device, a reviewer one, a couple of days ago. So from before the announcement, it's the only thing I've been able to find online. Apparently, there's a Samsung Galaxy Chromebook Plus coming out, which should be really good. It's Samsung getting back into that market. Nothing confirmed. So I'm sitting here, I want to talk about devices. I have money. I have money to buy a thing.
Shut up and take my money.
It's here. You can have it.
I want the thing.
Yeah. So, I think every 6 hours or so, I've been going and checking. Even when we started recording today, I'm maybe someone's posted something. Nothing.
No, I'm just having a look at the Chrome Unboxed website.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
Literally nothing there.
Yeah, if you check their threads, they posted okay, we're about to go into the thing.
Yep.
And then nothing.
Yeah, so there was a post 2 days ago, September 24th, or yesterday for the US. And it's what we'd like to see.
Yeah, but we're hoping to see today.
Yep. Yep, but nothing on what actually happened.
Yeah. So that's that was a bit of a bust. So maybe in the next 2 weeks there'll be something. We'll see. But I'm not making any promises. So
cross fingers.
Cross fingers. But. I did manage to get my hands on the new Google 4K Streamer, which just came out yesterday.
Yeah, so this is Google's set-top box.
This is, yeah. So it's not just a dongle that's hanging out the back of the thing. It actually is designed to sit on the desktop. And in my instance, I was using it to replace an Apple TV that I had plugged into an Android TV, but it was a really cheap one. So, you know, if you like the really cheap Android TV, it's got like a terrible CPU and it's just bad.
Mm. Yeah.
So I had this Apple TV, which was pretty good, but it's the only Apple device I own. So I swapped this stream of 4K in. So I've only been using it for about half a day now. Okay. And it's certainly better than the inbuilt one on the TV. It is a lot faster than that. It's not as fast as the Apple TV that it's replacing. And a couple of like little things, like the remote's pretty good, but it's plastic and it's very lightweight versus like the Apple TV is like this nice metal thing that you just recharge with USB-C. The Google one has batteries. So it's like, it's a little annoying. However, as like a home assistant device, it's pretty good.
Yeah.
Like it's kind of turning the TV that I've got it plugged into. It's like I've got it in the kitchen. And it makes it much more like a home hub. And the device itself is also like it's a Matter and Thread gateway as well. So it can do a lot of those things. It's already got like the integration with like if you have a Nest doorbell. If someone rings the doorbell, it will come up on the TV.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and like you can do the same thing with like the photo slideshow backgrounds and stuff.
Does it pause the show that you're watching?
No, it does a picture in picture.
Okay.
Yeah. I noticed this the other day. I was watching something and there was picture in picture going, and yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, so I think that's really nice. There's a bunch of Gemini logos throughout it. It's still sort of there's references to Home Assistant. Sorry, not Home Assistant, to the Google Assistant. But yeah, starting to see more Gemini stuff on there. So and yeah, it's good.
I read this little article yesterday. I think it was just on my Google News feed on my phone that said that the new remote control for the streamer works with the old Chromecast 4K as well. So you can buy the remote control and upgrade your Chromecast remote to one of these.
Yeah, I actually did see it was available separately for that. So yeah you could. But the thing itself wasn't that expensive. I think I think it was like $150 for the device. And it does have Ethernet on it this time, so that's nice.
Yeah, we only use ours in the caravan, so it's because all of our TVs are reasonably new Android TVs. So we've just got the little Chromecast, the white dongle, sort of double sided taped. Essentially, it's just velcroed to the back of the caravan TV, so it's out of the way. And we just use it that way.
And yeah, like this wouldn't do anything for me on my two main proper TVs. They've got decent CPUs and the Android TV experience on them is good.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. I've got like the latest shiny Samsung TV with all the Samsung apps in it and everything. And I'm trying to think of a use case for this compared to that.
Yeah.
It doesn't really replace that though.
No.
Yeah. It's more for I've got up in our bedroom, we've got this little JVC smart TV that's got Google TV on it. And this, much like your use case, Dave, the CPU in that thing is complete nonsense. Barely runs the TV, let alone any Google apps. So this would be a perfect use case for that, except that it's mounted up on the wall high up and I've just put a Chromecast up there because the new Chromecast has got all the apps anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you could do this too and you could just double-sided tape it to the back. Like it's not, it's still not that big. It's about the size of a phone, maybe a little smaller.
Okay.
So it's not too bad.
Yeah, nice.
It's not a Chromebook, but at least it was something. I got to actually touch something, so that was nice.
Got some hardware.
Doesn't even have Chrome in the name anymore.
No, it doesn't.
All right, cool then. I think that's enough of the news items. Let's get on with the AI Wars.
AI Wars.
And look, we struggled to find some AI Wars news this fortnight, but we had a couple come in at the last minute there. Now, talking about Dave Plummer, actually, and Dave's Garage, I saw a video of his just yesterday where he goes through and he installs the Olama model on WSL.
Oh, okay.
Very, very cool. I'll link it in the show notes. He goes through step by step exactly how to do it. I'll give it a crack myself. But yeah, you can have your own locally hosted model, obviously with no guardrails, none of that in place, and it can you can index your own documents and it's secure and all the rest of it. Now, on top of that, he installs a web UI from a container, and then it gives you a ChatGPT style web interface, so you can interact with it locally using that style of chat.
That's cool.
Right? And then not only that, once you've got that running, you can install other models. So you can do generative AI and blah, 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 blah. Very, very cool. So have a look at that video. I'll link that in the show notes.
See the rise of chaos AI coming back.
You can see the, exactly, yeah. Once they all start talking to each other. But outside of that, I also had a look at Kling AI. I don't know if you guys have seen this, Kling AI.
I have not.
Oh, my God. I'll link it in the show notes. So this is a new video generative AI model, and the videos it is creating are stunning, just to put it in a word. Now, one of the most challenging things that video gen AI can do is of people eating, and of course, we know the Will Smith eating noodles has become a meme now. if you look at the videos, I'll link in the show notes of, you know, the dude eating noodles, it's just insane. Like, it's highly consistent, it's clear, I mean, you would be hard pressed to pick that as a Gen AI image.
I was watching that one of the dude eating the noodles on the street.
Yeah,
and the thing that'll always catch out a video as AI generated is the background, because the background is always a thing that you'll see a car drive past and it'll get past the person that's in focus and it just disappears into the ether.
Yep. Or like, there's people walking backwards and stuff like that. Yeah.
Magic car.
That's the thing about this model. It's consistent.
Yeah. And that was what I was just about to say. I was watching the videos that it's creating and going, I can't tell if that's actually like an actual video or if that's generated AI. That's insane.
Yeah. That's the thing about this Kling AI. Now, it's open source. That's the other exciting thing about it. And at the moment, I think you can sign up for some free credits, and it can create a 10-second video at the moment.
Wow.
Now, the other thing you can do with it is you've got a there's a director mode. So you can have a scene and you can draw, like, there's a tool where they've got where you draw arrows for each, like you circle like the dog and you draw an arrow, and then you circle the car and you draw an arrow. And as it builds the frames, those objects in the scene will move in that direction. So you can direct the scene.
Yeah, wow. That's pretty scary.
Well, I don't know if that's scary, but yeah.
It's scary that we can't tell the difference now. That's the thing. That's the bit I'm worried about is, like, once upon a time, you could tell the difference. Like, if people had 13 fingers or they had one finger or 6 feet. But
this is crossing the uncanny valley.
Yeah.
And there's one of the videos I'm looking at the moment. I mean, if you go to clingai.com, there'll be like a best creative sort of wall, and that updates all the time. But there's one I'm looking at the moment of a dog swimming in a pool. And I don't know. There's nothing about it that gives it away as AI.
Yeah.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, absolutely crazy. So go and check that out. Another one of aliens playing the piano.
Yeah, I was just looking at that one. That is really good.
That is good. Two things to check out there, Olama and Kling AI. But I was just flicking through once again the Google app this morning, and I've mentioned this in the past on GCP Life. How are we going to power all these AI data centers? And I jokingly said, you know, well, they're going to build a data center and put a nuclear reactor next to it. I mean, it's the only way, right? Well, Microsoft has gone and made a deal with Three Mile Island to that three mile island to refire one of their reactors and get 100% of the power from it. It's happening, people. It is happening. I told you.
The nuclear-powered AI apocalypse.
The nuclear-powered AI. Like I said, Dave, we won't even need to block out the sun, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah.
That'll be nuclear-powered.
It's Chaos AI's next step in their domination.
So, yeah, this story is Microsoft signs historic nuclear power deal to fuel AI data centers. The owner of the infamous Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in the US has announced a $1.6 billion plan to restart the operation to power a series of AI data centers owned by Microsoft.
I wonder if they're going to build like DCs, or if they have DCs that are going to be co-located, or it's just more like, you know, we're paying for this amount that gets fed into the grid.
I don't know.
Well, they could build transmission wires straight to the data center and build the data centers nearby. That wouldn't stop them. Look, the backstory on this, for those of you that may not know, us old grey hairs here, March 1979, Three Mile Island was a brand new reactor at the time, and Unit 2 had suffered a failure and a core meltdown as a result. It's since been and some radioactive gas leaked into the atmosphere. So as a result, that's been shut down. The entire plant was shut down since then. That only affected Reactor 2. Reactor 1 is still has still been functional and usable up to this point, and now Microsoft's offering to reactivate it.
And they're looking to get 835 megawatts out of it. That's a lot of power.
Yep.
That's a
lot
of power.
Not quite 1 gigawatt. That's a lot of power, yep. I'm telling you, this is just the first step. I mean, what's it going to take now for Microsoft to go, right, we know, because they're going to learn how nuclear power works. Well, they kind of do know already, because Bill Gates has a side gig where he's building nuclear power plants anyway. I don't know if you know.
I think it's their modular reactors they've been trying.
Their modular reactors, yeah, right.
I didn't know about that. Because I always thought he was against nuclear.
Only way we're going to power the future.
Oh, yeah, I 100% agree with that. I think
let's not get into that debate about the Australian nuclear reactors, but fusion's not going to happen for a little while. Fission is the way to go. We can manage the waste, that's fine, and it's relatively clean. Northern European countries have come up with ways of managing the waste, and they've been doing nuclear power for a long time. But it's not a far stretch to see one of these hyperscalers go, right, we're going to build a bunch of data centers and a power plant to go along with it.
Oh, no, I don't see them commit. Like, Three Mile Island is one thing because the reactor's there and they can recommission. I don't see any of the hyperscalers looking and saying, like, yeah, we want to take the 20-year plus commitment to build a reactor from zero.
That's true. Unless they can come up with a way to fast track the build.
Well, I know that ANSTO in Australia is talking it can take, for the small module reactors, they're looking at 5 years.
They don't exist. Like, there is, they don't, that you can't, there's not one anywhere, right? Like, they've been talking about building, no one has one anywhere.
Yeah, well,
so it's like, yeah, it would be great if they were available, then we could do it, but yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see it happen because, yeah, at the moment, I mean, in Australia, we're all mostly gas-fired power plants, which is
horrible.
Much the same as firing with coal, to be honest.
Yeah,
it's horrible.
Because
we sold all our gas overseas. So.
Yeah, firing with coal, you're not sort of shoveling big lumps of coal into a furnace. It's actually ground up into like a talcum powder and sprayed in. So it still burns pretty well 100%. But gas-fired versus coal-fired, I mean, you're still pumping truckloads of CO2 into the atmosphere. Whereas a nuclear reactor, you're not. It's the only thing that's coming out of those stacks is steam.
Yeah, that's right.
And the nuclear waste, like a rod, will last for 20 years. So
that's right.
You're only getting rid of those rods once every 20 years.
Yeah, and that can be managed, right? Yeah. Once that comes out, that can be sort of put into a granite mountain or something and then encased, and that's it. It's sequestered away. You never have to think about it again.
Yeah.
So this is going to be the biggest problem facing the AI hyperscalers. There's no doubt. Where are they going to get the power from?
Yeah, because all those things take a lot.
I don't know if you heard of the solar duck. Right, so the solar duck it's a graph, and it shows what happens with power costs during like the middle and latter part of the days when solar is very high but demand is low, and it's where its power prices get pushed into negative. And you start having to do like load shedding. Like, for example, there's a bunch of industries like Bitcoin mining. A bunch of the big Bitcoin miners get paid money to turn up capacity during the solar duck.
Right.
It's a stability thing.
Right. Yeah.
Because obviously, if you've got a coal fire or gas fire plants can turn on pretty quickly, but the coal fire ones, they have a ramping time. So if you're going to lose money every time it's running, like if you have to pay $100 a kilowatt to feed it into the grid, you ain't going to want to run that reactor.
Right.
I mean, they're talking about doing that for solar in Australia.
Well, yeah, but this is what I'm talking about. So we've got the solar duck. And that's where, like, you know, maybe we'd end up with a situation with AI where it's like, okay, well, certain workloads are more likely, or maybe use less credits. All right, if you think of like a credit-based system, like, okay, it might cost, if you want to run something on this model between 12 and 3 p.m., you might not use any credits. But if you want it at like 7 p.m. at night, you're going to pay a premium for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, that's fair.
All right. So similar to how your power costs are if you've got like peak and off-peak power.
Yeah.
Right. Well, this is where your battery technology comes in.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. To do peak shaving to fill those gaps in.
Yeah. So, for example, like at a very, very small scale. So, like for my 3D printing business, we have a battery, and we use that to dodge the peak period. All right. So we charge during off peak. So we either get a solar that feeds in as much as possible, and then for the very latter part of the off peak period, we charge our batteries, and then we run them down during the peak period.
Yeah, nice. Right,
so we don't always make it. Like sometimes we still end up having to pay the full rate, but most of our consumption comes as off peak.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we try and run everything during the day here when we're generating solar. So like the hot water system turns on during the day, the pool's on during the day, all of our load heavy stuff is on during the day where we're powering it via solar. And then at night it's like every single light in this house is LED. So there's a lot of them because it's a big house, but they're all LED. And we generally don't run the air conditioners. I mean, they're just nice wall artifacts for us at the moment. Come middle of summer, they won't be wall artifacts. They'll be used.
We'll wait till February.
It'll be critical infrastructure.
Yeah. January or February, they will be 24/7.
We just run all the things all the time. That seems to be what happens in my house.
Yeah, well, even when no one's home.
We did, but then we got an electricity bill of like $1,700. Went, no, not doing that again.
All right, then. Let's move on. The final article for the AI Wars and for the show this week is the State of AI Report. Now, you brought this to my attention, Ian. How's this work?
Yeah, so look, this is just something that IT News puts out. It's much the same as like the State of DevOps report that goes on and a huge heap of other ones in the market, but it's just essentially the different industries that use AI and where they're at currently. CSIRO is estimating that digital innovations, including AI, could contribute $315 billion to Australia's GDP by 2030, which is that's an awful lot of coin. While a University of Adelaide is reporting greater AI utilization could boost Australia's GDP by $200 billion annually. So, I mean, that's a lot of coin, like right off the bat now. What is clear in the various reports that I have scanned through, which is only three of the seven that are available, is that organisations that are seeing the greatest returns are those that started early. So those that jumped on board right from the get-go, they're the ones that are seeing the greatest returns of AI. And that's just purely because they've learnt the ropes. They know how to adapt to that ever-changing landscape of the AI models that are updated what feels like almost daily. It's really not, but when you're developing something that uses AI, it definitely feels like it's a daily occurrence. But just one here, Andrew Haddad, who's the Chief Information Officer at AGL, the energy company, has said his organization's engagement with AI is suitably broad, including preventative maintenance programs, churn reduction, and improved customer case management. So they're using it for a whole heap of different use cases. I know that there is a very major insurer in the country that is using AI to do fraud detection. So if you upload photos of an accident, they can cross-reference that with a whole heap of other photos of accidents. And they can also try and detect if those photos are AI generated and see the narrative that's been put around it to see if it has been either generated or used before. So there you go. There's a brief overview of the State of AI report.
All right, and that's something you can go for and sign up, and I'll send that out to you, and you can get an update on the state of AI. Fantastic. Well, gentlemen, I think we've reached the end of the show for this fortnight. It's been a blast.
It has, hasn't it?
It has indeed. Don't forget, you can...
Dave, you
can go to iTunes, write us a review. You can find us on iTunes, Spotify, and YouTube Music. While you're at YouTube Music, go there, hit that like button, and start the discussion on YouTube. You can contact us, contact@gcpbytes.com.au, and you can find us on the website, www.gcpbytes.com.au. And of course, today's sponsors were Hive Tech Solutions and Mantle Group. That's about it from us. Anything from you guys?
Have a great fortnight.
No, nothing exciting.
you said all the exciting stuff and we're all done. Well, we'll catch you later. We're out of here. Bye.
Bye.
See ya.
And I can only ever think of that line from The Simpsons, the king size Homer episode where he's really fat. Mm. And, after Mr. Burns goes to give him the award, he's like, his quick thinking prevented this from becoming a potential Chernobyl and down to a mere 3 mile island.
Well, whenever I think of that episode, I think of the bird and it presses the Y. I just tripled my productivity.
Venting prevents explosion.
My wife and I laugh about that all the time too.
I haven't watched The Simpsons in years.